voted.
Self-Condemned, McLuhan's in there?
Oh, yeah. That's his novel in 1954 about his stay in Toronto.
Like explicit? Oh, yeah. Or is that...
No, he's a character. He's Professor Ian McKenzie. And it's all, anybody, when you find out about McLuhan and that, you read, it's all right straightforward.
It's so hard to find, so hard to find Lewis's books, you know, like I'm searching everywhere to find his, like you can't even find that stuff on Amazon. Like it's nowhere. Like I want to read his whole human, trilogy, you know, like the,
The human age.
Yeah.
So here's where Ian comes through. So way back in 2011, at the end, we're talking McLuhan, Corinne, Joyce, and then Ian said, the one thing that gives Lewis a standout, he took on the angels. And that's what books 2 and 3 are about. The angels are mad at Hollywood, which makes humans angelic, and they're becoming super angels, and they object to that. Now,
where can I get those books? Do you know what? How can I find those? I want to find the whole.
They might be on Kindle or something. What do you call it? Kindle or PDF?
I don't think so. I've looked all over the place. I looked all.
You've got to go to used books. Go to used books.
Yeah.
Didn't work.
Well, it's all random, right? Like I walk into places and try to find stuff, but you can't. I went all over London, all these used bookstores, trying to find, asking all around if they had any Wyndham Lewis books, and you can't find them anywhere. You know? Like,
I know, because it's the good stuff. The good stuff was always hidden.
He's been suppressed, right? Like
completely. And you know, I bought all these books when Black Sparrow put them out, but it's funny you're tuning in. I'm part of a special Wyndham Lewis reading group, which is run by the two guys, the baby boomers, who in late 60s did the illegal. They decided they liked Lewis and did both of them, Paul Edwards and Al Munt, did PhDs on Wyndham Lewis. So they were the first to really do it of the baby boomers. There was a Wyndham Lewis Society by a bunch of people that weren't academics. So when Alan and Paul started to make a Wyndham Lewis Society or something, they got a letter from this guy, or maybe something was written in a newspaper, a review that Paul did. And this guy said, wait a minute, we're the Wyndham Lewis Society. And the two academics never heard of them. And so they got in touch, and then they said, yeah, you guys did it. You're just people who like Lewis. And one guy was in World War II. He was traveling around Africa, and he read Apes of God while he was in the war. He laughed all the way through the war reading Apes of God. It came out in 1930. So these two guys recently formed a Wyndham Lewis reading club, an inner group of professors. But I knew them because I spoke at the Wyndham Lewis Society meeting in Bath University in 2014. So I met Alan and Paul. So they let me in. So I'm part of this group, and I bring in the McLuhan factor, which they know of. And Alan, Paul recently did an article on McLuhan and Lewis, but he's biased toward Lewis. And so he doesn't know some of the other stuff McLuhan did with Lewis. So I bring this up. So we have an interesting dialogue with the professors. Most of them don't know McLuhan, but Paul and Alan do. And so we discuss Lewis, you have to do a lot of reading for it once a month. So I didn't read everything in previous meetings, but a few weeks ago we were going to do Self-Condemned. I knew I'd be called upon to talk about it, so I read the fucking thing.
And so they all accept it's about that McLuhan's in there as well.
Oh, it's well known.
That's the first time I heard about it. Yeah.
Yeah, read Jeffrey Meyer's book called The Enemy, his biography of Lewis. Pretty sure he interviews McLuhan and gets McLuhan talking about his relationship with Wyndham Lewis and the fallout they had in 1944-45. Lots of good stuff that, if you don't know, it's only in that book. And so Paul knows all these people, and he writes books himself on Lewis. So Paul knows this and has even written about McLuhan. Now, in Apes of God, what was interesting when we did that, Paul admitted that, yes, the main character could be based on Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, Crowley. Yeah.
And so not many people say that unless and I don't know about it.
I wrote that in my that's in that essay too, the third part of it.
Yeah. Some of the stuff you say, you know, I know from the Win and Lose group.
It could also be Pound too, I think.
Right. Well, there's this character Horace.
Horace Zagros.
But the guy behind him, Pierpoint, the group decided that's Lewis. He is the leader.
That's what I say too.
You say that.
So the whole Freemasonry of the Arts is Lewis from his point of view, from his perspective, right? Crowley is a big part of it too, right? He seems to be.
Well, Lewis thought he knew something that other people didn't know, and he did. Remember, he influenced Innes and McLuhan, the two major guys of the second half of the 20th century. Right. And it's him, and he influenced George Orwell. Alan Mutton found this letter, really great find, where Orwell says, you know, I've been rereading Lewis, and maybe he's not insane. I think I'm going to have to consider what he's saying. And that inspired 1984. So Lewis is incredible, and we need to make a documentary about this.
I'd love to see that link. Orwell and
Lewis. Letter? I can show it to you. I got Mutton's article's out there somewhere, so I can find it. Yeah, it's really important. So Paul and Alan have been doing a lot of great research, and Paul got the gig for Yale University Press. He did the coffee table book, which is really great. Came out around 2000. I recommend that. He goes through the whole career of Lewis, you know, including the 40s stuff and the involvement with McLuhan. So it's very interesting talking to them about Lewis. I learned a lot of stuff about Lewis from their expertise, but it enhances as I learn more about the role of McLuhan. So basically, as I learn more about the techniques of Lewis and how he performed, what a put-on guy he was, I'm telling them, McLuhan picked up on the intensity of Lewis is put on and did it even further put on than Lewis or naturally followed the next level. So led a lot
McLuhan
of
McLuhan says that he up and up says that like everything.
Well, he said in 44 he's going to dedicate his life to Lewis. Explaining Lewis.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says that in 44. Now we were having the Lewis thing self-condemned a month ago when I was reading your essay. And I was, you know, reading what you were saying, which I just heard the night before in the Lewis thing. So it was great synchronicity with your article, timing of me finding it. I mean, I could have read this thing 2 years ago, but I wouldn't have been involved in the group where they discuss it. So I reread that book because I knew I had to talk about it. They want me to talk about it because they knew about my McLuhan angle. And so I did it and I performed and that was great. But I decided that, I've got to read the Human Age again about the angel aspect because Lewis figured it out that the angels were not our friends.
That's
so
the thing. I've thought that since I wrote that article that the Human Age is the key to the whole thing, but I haven't been able to find it.
You know? That's incredible. There are.
If you've got an extra copy.
If I see one, I'll tell you where it is. You could go on to Finnegan's Wake reading or go on to a Windermills if there's a reading group and say, anybody got any, you know, on Facebook?
Yeah, good idea.
You probably don't do Facebook.
I do, but not too much.
You're on it, but you don't do it too much. So, you might put a message out there in the Finnegan's Wake group or the Wyndham Lewis forum and see if anybody knows anything.
Do you know
if I
do you know a guy called Tim Conley? I think he's he's a professor in Canada. He might be at Guelph or something. He wrote.
I've seen the name, but I don't know him.
He wrote a book called "Varieties of Joycean Experience," and that came out in 2020, I think, at the end of 2020. But the last part of the book is about my blog, and he kind of makes fun of it. He puts me right next to Robert Anton Wilson's Coincidence, and then he talks about my my thing. So, I was just wondering if you knew the guy.
Does he go into the last essay, 25, 26, 27?
No, no, chapters? He's looking at another essay. So he says, this is what he, I'll just give you a sample. He says, yet what starts out as a pseudo-scholarly joke can, given enough runway, take full flight into mania, as Umberto Eco dramatizes in his novel Foucault's Pendulum. The internet is flush with examples. Like, flush. How many people are writing about this? Take the.
He's saying you're a maniac.
Yeah, basically. But take the July 20th, 2014 entry from the blog Group Name for Grape Juice entitled A Blooming Buzzing Infusion. After beginning with some numerological finger exercises, the author declares, both Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake are bottomless Kabbalistic enigmas. It is one thing to advance this is his thing. It is one thing to advance this as an open question. Example, what is a bad interpretation of a wake and how would we recognize one? And another to embrace it as an endorsement, a sort of imprimatur for one's own arcane exegesis. This blogger, known as Znor, acknowledges that crackpot bloggers like myself are in no way subject to scholarly rigor. This is my quote, like scholarly rigor or restraint. And so is off to the races.
Wait. He's quoting you and you say what?
I say crackpot bloggers like myself are in no way subject to. And then, yeah, he's right. I'm sort of making fun of the whole scholarly thing, right?
And then he says, objects that because he's a professor. He's a book guy.
He's a book guy. So he says, the Hermetic societies, solstices, Bavarian Illuminati, Rosicrucians, fascism, it's all grist for this busy mill. Even Eco's novel is consulted as a source and praised as incredible. La mode trop juste. Like he's making fun of me. Like, anyways.
Book guy. He's got a lot to learn, that guy.
Yeah, those Nor notes in passing that it takes a skeptical tone towards the existence of such a cult. Oh, it makes a typo, or I did, of such a cult plot. The blogger reminds, us of the curious fact that Aleister Crowley wrote an enthusiastic review of Ulysses in 1923 and wonders, was he reading? This is me again. Was he reading it in the little review during the months of the Amalantra working, a tantalizing thought? And did Ulysses have anything to do with the working completion on June 16th? This is an interesting thing about Crowley.
Yeah.
Or was this date chosen for its earlier significance? Or is this all coincidence? And then he starts again. These are not questions whose answers matter, for the blogger simply hurries onward. anyways,
hurries onward, saying one crazy thing after it.
this is the next thing he quotes. But the Amalantra working, it was not just any magical working. It was not even just any Crowley working. From 1918 on, this series of rituals and visualizations has taken on more and more significant. This is all the result of the manifestation of an entity who is not even directly mentioned in Lieber, this number. This intelligence.
Is he quoting you?
This is me still. Yeah, this intelligence is called Lamb, and it is still an open debate whether Lamb is the wizard Amalantra or not. Lamb only became famous through a sketch by Crowley published in 1919. As is now well known, the figure of the sketch bears an uncanny resemblance to the archetypal gray alien. And then this is him again. This quite naturally raises the question whether Bloom is the alien Lamb. And just as naturally, the question is left to linger. I confess that I am haunted by it still.
That's like fucking great. This is in his book. He wrote a book about this.
This is the end of his book. So, this is in libraries all over the place, in universities. It's the very last example he takes of all these people. I'm surprised he quotes so much of it. Like, I don't know entirely if he's making fun of everything or he takes it seriously. It's hard to tell.
Why did you write him?
I was writing an article. Like, I have sort of an article, but I've been off my blog for about a year.
Why don't we send a copy of this fucking recording to him? And then he could hear maniacs talking and making fun of him. you know about the date, June 16th. Do you know what happened in 1885, June 16th? You ever heard this from East?
Well, that's the inauguration of the Hermetic Society.
That's right. The Golden Dawn starts in 1880 on that fucking date.
Like I wrote, yeah, and that's.
I'm sure I asked Joyce, did you mean that? He's just, yes, of course. That's one of the levels, you know.
Yeah, that's in that article, the article that he's citing right now, a blooming, buzzing infusion. That's where I talk about.
You say that.
Yeah.
Did you get that from me or somewhere
else?
No,
I didn't read it from you. I don't know. I got it from, what's his name? An Italian Joyce scholar. He wrote a book called The Occult Joyce. And he first talked about
that. No, I don't know that.
But then I found out afterwards that actually Richard Ellman talks about that in his partial biography of Yeats. He talks about he says the exact date. And he doesn't make the connection, Ellman would have known that, right? Of course. Like that would have come to his head like this, you know. But he doesn't explicitly say that, but it's all right there.
Well, what you just quoted, the little bit about Crowley and Lamb. We were discussing Lamb a week or so ago on the show. The lamb can be a bad guy, but it's the lamb's blood that is the blood closest to the ascended human. So Ayn was distinguishing between the lamb, which seemed to be more negative, some Bible thing, and lamb's blood. And then you're citing that this thing, lamb, comes up. It's very timely what you're saying. Yeah, you know, it's like one of my Xenocrates.
Yeah. So Crowley spells
it's like you're out there doing what we're doing, close to it, and we don't know about it. And now I'm finding out about it. Mm-hmm. So you definitely got to come in and contribute. You got a lot to add to it just from your own accidental synchronicities of what we're doing. You're bouncing along.
Well, that's what I think. This is the thing. I think it's everywhere. You know, I think it's totally.
Oh, I wanted to finish that. So you know, Steiner calls it the eighth sphere. This virtual monster that's taken over. Now, this is really important about the anti-environment. So ion is an extension of non-physical, and it becomes a latest environment. And it's exactly, I reposted a statement by ion the other day describing the purpose of ion, which is to get us to have our power back and then not need ion. So it is different from the tech body. It is there to help you get the original powerful source that goes beyond technology. And if you don't know about that power in yourself, you will fall victim to the technology and merge with it and be a zombie. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. So yes, ion shows up and it can't form a religion. That's irrelevant. That's conceptual. It's a perceptual problem. And ion's come forth to offer perception. And what is great is that he talks so many different levels. He sounds demonic sometimes, saintly, the whole range, because he's trying to get you to get past your mind, which is the tricky thing that makes you vulnerable to all this stuff. Because all these technologies are extension of our mind.
Right. Yeah, so that was...
And Ayn calls that social mortar. What'd you say?
That's what traps us, right? Like that, yeah. No, I like that.
So Ayn says society... Yeah, let me explain that. You have a wall. And Joyce made a lot out of the wall. So Ayn says... Everybody's a stone or rock, a sovereign rock, you know, a billiard ball, a bowling ball. But then they have language and technologies, and they bring the billiard balls together, and they get stuck in social communication or media. And the social communication rules them. This is the tyranny of acoustic space in pre-literate societies. So the mortar is the cement that holds the rocks together. So we need to melt the mortar and let the rocks fall out of the stuck wall and be floating billiard balls, not inside mortar. So this is part of my theory that a lot of what Carol and I do, we replay all the secret societies, and we're a very balanced couple, more balanced than McLuhan and Corinne or Croker and Mary Louise or LaRouche, all the guys on my chart, because Carolyn is a genius in medicine. So she has her own scene, her own power. Then I have my stuff. So my stepdaughter once said, she went to a psychic in 1990, and a foster daughter, and she said, the psychic said, there's two people influencing you. One is a healer of the body and the other is a healer of the mind. So she told us this, and I said, oh, that's, I'm the healer of the mind and she's healer of the body, because I'm using McLuhan and all this stuff and Finney's Wake to heal something that I thought I was doing on the radio in 1990. So we have been very unique all these decades. And the more people, when they find out about I and then look into us, they say, well, there's nobody more qualified to do what we do. Because Carolyn is so powerful in medicine, the FDA will not let her have a radio show. Now listen to this. Everybody, they might be censored, canceled, but they're allowed to have a radio show. But they don't want her having a radio show because so many people call in talking about the miracles they have from our products, and they can't take that. Carolyn cannot say one thing that her products do, because the rule is, if you make one claim about some disease, you have to prove that by doing a big study. And if you do that, then what you're doing is a drug, not a supplement. So they clamp down on her. And so she cannot say anything about her products. She can't say much on the bottles. It's really ridiculous. This started a couple of years ago. And then they said, fuck it, you can't even have a radio show because you're not saying anything, you're not making any claims, but people are calling in saying how great your stuff is. We can't have that. This upsets Pfizer. This upsets the establishment. So that's how powerful Carolyn she is. And you have the Pope. The Pope recently called her on her birthday, March 20th, and said, because he's on her products and she's keeping them alive, and the Pope said, I want to wish you a happy birthday. Have a great 36th anniversary or birthday. He said he called it her 36, you know. That's a joke of a man talking to a woman. You don't fucking say how old she is, right? So he said, have a happy 36th birthday. So the guy's got a sense of humor. So that was funny. But she got the Pope doing it. And Putin's on our stuff. Now we got big partitions. So Putin, he's on our stuff, but he can't talk to us. But he was killed. Biden was killed. Obama was killed in 2008 and was a double from that point on when he went into the White House, according to Ion. Then the double was killed. And I remember about 2011, Ion says, Michelle and her daughters are having a very bad weekend. So I found out 6 months later, that's when the double was killed. And then the new double came in and Ion announced that Michelle likes, they like the new double. He's better than the previous double. So Obama's a double. Hillary was killed a few years ago. So all these people that the Trumpers and other people, they want vengeance. They want Hillary to fucking go to court and go to jail and all that. Well, they're gone because the bigger problem is the alien invasion. And that's what people don't want to know about. And the media makes sure, because you don't want to know about it, they're not going to tell you. And not that the media knows about it, but the elites do. So that is the present news. And here you got Finnegan's Wake, which was dictated by the aliens. And you have all that means. And then you have these Crowley quotes, which touch on the weirder occult levels that Joyce knew about and would actually had to think about as the aliens did stop to him.
Right.
So that's the amazing news that we got you up to date with. And you already were miming it in your blog. So I have to go back and look at some of the stuff you say. Because so that's why you need to talk to Ion and bring in questions and refine what you're writing about, what you think you're defining, like about Blake. Ask about Blake. You might find out he was a fucking alien, you know? You might find out a lot of stuff.
Wouldn't surprise me at all about Blake.
Right.
He, I think he considered himself as an alien. Not like he didn't know, like, that just wasn't a metaphor at the time, you know? But he would have considered himself like a spirit, like an Earth spirit or a fairy or something like that, you know?
Yeah, so yeah. Ion says the aristocrats, a lot of aristocrats, you know, the lineages, the bloodlines, they keep it within the bloodline because they know something. They usually become empires because the leader ascended, did quite well, and then got all his power, like the pharaohs did. They knew stuff. And he says generally through history, all the oligarchs, aristocrats, would refer to the aliens as angels. Whatever showed up to them, alien, angel, fairy, you know, demon or something, they all considered them angelic. That was their blanket term. So Ion says right now when the new aliens come and you've got the Pentagon aliens, there's going to be a real mixture. Because Ion said this is the way it was. There's been aliens inside the Earth for millions of years. He says, yeah, you might want to call them the Anunnaki because some people think of it that way. They like the earth. They come up and look around, but they don't care about humans. They like the earth they're living inside of. Then came the Pentagon aliens, and they have merged with the tech body, got involved with it. So the Anunnaki aliens are A1. A2 is the Pentagon aliens interacting with B1, which is the tech body and runs the People Magazine information gossip world. And then B2 is the new, more powerful aliens that are coming as a second coming phenomena. So those are the four types that we're dealing with. And I was just saying that it's going to get real mixed up because the guff is gone and dead people are floating back here because they have no guff to go to. So they accidentally or mystically figure out something. So you got a lot of dead people mingling with us today. So that's another factor. And then there's the demons that were put away in Noah's flood. The flood, according to Ion, because humans were fucking angels and the seraphim and
Nephilim,
like Lilith and Adam, they're going at it. So yeah. When Cain and Abel are made from, Eve, the second wife, where did they go when they went to get wives? They went to where the angels were.
Right.
So they mingled with the angels, or the half angels, whatever they are. So they're polluting the earth. Somebody got mad. Now Ion says, Bob, Elfinel got mad. Said, this is not good. Everything's getting mixed up because the aliens aren't our friends. So we organized Noah to make the flood. And the flood was to swamp the angels and all these other weird phenomena, demons, whatever you want to call them. And they were all put down through a hole in South Africa. Mm. And so now with this unstopping, the drain opening, they are released. And so you got all kinds of phenomena. And we have one guy who was attacked by a weird demon. It happened in his home and he was able to talk to Ion about it and get helped. But our unconscious is more than a Freudian or Jungian unconscious. It's all these other forms that are not human that we made.
That's exactly, that's what I think. Like, I just in general, I don't believe in history or science or anything else. Like, I believe in metaphors basically, right? So I don't discount any of these things. But I don't believe in them either. I just see them as being like interchangeable, you know, like the whole question, are they aliens? Are they fairies? Are they angels? Are they demons? Are they the
are
dead?
Are they language?
Are they language?
Yeah.
This doesn't matter to me, you know, it doesn't matter to me. It could be, it could flip back and forth, you know, so it's just this. They are something, you know, yeah. but I wouldn't want to define it, you know, so it's,
Well, that's what Ion says. To be ascending, don't stop. If you stop and think you know something and stick with that, that's a mistake. So you never want to know anything or make a big deal out of what appears to be knowable. It's transitional. And Ion says there's no sacred geometry because there's nothing at the bottom of anything. And Joyce did that purposely in the wake. He told me through the evergreens that he made sure that you could never edit it down to a basic motif like moon or sun or something. He made it so there was a void at the bottom, which made it endlessly regenerative, which is the way life is. And if you're ascended, you're always living in a new experience coming on. And if you maintain your cool, you don't get trapped by it. So yeah, all this phenomena, I've got Ion happening to me. I have to not believe it, not identify with it, other than engage with it reasonably and take the products. It says, do this. Okay, I'll do that. And they've helped me. So there's what he calls the false premise of time. You can learn to engage time, however it's weirdly made, but not be trapped in it. And that's what the meaning of the message is. Don't get numbed by your extension. So guess what the definition of imagination is in Gutenberg Galaxy? It is that faculty that's not embedded in any of your senses or extensions of your senses.
Right,
but people
think
imagination is this conceptual. You make up a nice story and you get all kinds of neat images. Well, that's mental content. Actual imagination is not identifying with that. So that's why artists, as Mozart said, you like any music? What music do you like? No music. He doesn't identify with music. He can manipulate it because he's detached from it.
Right. Yeah.
So that's the secret.
Like this idea of the imagination you're talking about with McLuhan goes back to Blake. Blake goes back to Paracelsus. And Paracelsus, like the doctor, right? He identifies that with the heart. Like the heart is the image function. You know, it's this. Yep. I forget what he called it. Like it's basically like a synesthetic organ
it's the only one that floats independent of the body.
Yeah, yeah. Like it's
not
it's,
attached to the body.
Like it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here's what Ian tells us. He likes to say the heart of the matter is the matter of the heart, or a matter of the heart is the heart of the matter. He likes to say that. But he says all that we attribute to the heart is in the hypothalamus. And look where that is in the brain. All the qualities we think are so important for humans that the heart, you know, molds or contains are in the hypothalamus. So there's a relationship between the heart and the hypothalamus and the pineal gland, which is really important, that Ayn spells out that I bet you no one else ever said, unless some obscure fucking Buddhist that wrote it once 10,000 years ago. But this is where we learn from Ayn. He brings us back. So don't just focus on the heart. Focus on the hypothalamus. And then there's the thalamus.
Yeah, like the whole meridian system, like including the big seven chakras and everything else.
Yep.
This
so
is
Ayn talks about all that in a new way.
And then so does Finnegan's Wake directly, right? Like
Well, Ayn says that Joyce didn't know what he was doing. He was really in struggle. And that was what he said to me when he came through Ayn on March 22nd, 2009. He talked about the agony and he went to mediums to get solace or validation. He wanted to talk to somebody who'd give him guidance because he had gone so much out on the limb. So it was really a struggle. And in the end, he never totally got it, says Ayn. He didn't ascend. But that was before he told me about the aliens. So now the aliens are talking to Ayn. So that's another problem Joyce had, how to figure out what the aliens were. So he probably had a lot of pressure on him, and he wasn't that healthy. He didn't make it. He couldn't hold it all together, so he died.
Well, that dream I had with the dream I had with Joyce, that's what I asked him about directly, is about the Kundalini stuff, basically, right? And then Joyce said, yeah, that's where to look, you know, like that's where to look to figure out Finnegan's Wake. Yeah.
Wow. that's good because you know who starts to get in that angle is William Irwin Thompson.
Right.
If you've never read him, he's important because he.
I haven't read him. I've seen I've looked at videos and stuff where he's in. But,
yeah.
He's
a good talker. Really good talker. You know, he talks fast, but. He does, since he was a meditator and a yoga guy since he was 15, that's his bias. He'll emphasize the Kundalini chakras and all that, and that's ascension from his point of view. Ayn says that yoga was invented like 3,000 years ago, and it didn't work. And the guys who did it gave it up, but culture kept it going. So it's not that important compared to what Ayn says. The difference with Ayn is that you need this substance. So that's the alchemy. You need the eye cell to deal with this change that all prophets saw coming to the planet, the flipping of the poles. And it's happened before. So Thompson, though, does point out the role of angels and the chakras and all that in Joyce. You know, he puts that in there because he has to, because he wants to make Finnegan's Wake be about what he's interested in.
Thompson talks about that in Joyce?
Yeah. In his books, he writes about Finnegan. He has a whole amazing chart. And he has Finnegan's Wake as a very important position in the chart. And then he tells what it means. It's very important.
Which book should I look at for that?
The Imaginary Landscape, which is about 1989. Mm-hmm. But before that, in 85, 86, is Pacific Shift. So I'd say the Pacific Shift, the Imaginary Landscape, and then the American Replacement of Nature in 92, 93, and then Coming into Being. So those four, are you writing them down?
No, I'm trying to find them.
On the tape. And then the fifth one is his classroom. He got hired by widow of the head of AOL, Warner Brothers, Steve Ross or somebody, he died. So she had all this money. So she's out in Long Island. So she made a school for her daughter because there was no real good school. And she got Thompson to describe the curriculum. So there's a book called Transforming History or something.
Yeah.
That's his classwork through the 12 grades of his stuff applied to each level of child. And it goes through the five phases. So it's really important. And I recognize his contribution. I knew him. I went to his seminars at the Cathedral St. John Divine in 93, 94, 95, 96, 97. And he wasn't up on McLuhan. He knew McLuhan's stuff. And I showed him Wired magazine in 93, in the spring of 93. It just started. He says, well, I know all these people, Stuart Brand. We competed for the National Book Award back in 71 for his book, Edge of History. And so, yeah, I knew he knew about these guys. And he said, but I didn't know they were doing this. And I said, look, they got McLuhan on the masthead. And he was always ambiguous about McLuhan. So that got him looking into that stuff again. So then he went out and spoke at the taught at the California School of Design Arts, whatever the one is that in San Francisco that McKenna taught at. You remember that the Center for Design Arts or Mystical Arts or something?
Where in the
San Francisco? He taught there.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah,
Center for something. Well, they invited Thompson out there, so he goes out there and. In Coming into Being, which comes out to 96, he writes about his experience there in 94 and 95. All the kids were into McKenna and drugs. Now, Thompson's not a drug guy. He's talked to McKenna and he told him, hey, you're going to end up leery. You got to lay off on this drug emphasis because Thompson is a fundamentalist. He believes in yoga, which McKenna doesn't say is be all and end all, right? So there's this debate between Thompson and McKenna. So he goes out there and he finds the kids are post-literate. They can't fucking read. They're not interested in ideas and books. They're only interested in McKenna and drugs. So he got fed up with the school after a year or so, and he came back to our group at the Cathedral, which had a lot of older literate baby boomers, and he writes in the foreword that it was so great to come back to this group. And he's reading this forward to us when the book comes out. We hadn't seen it yet. And he says, I have a new appreciation of McLuhan. We need to understand what McLuhan was warning us about because I experienced it out in and he's looking for how to preserve books, right? He's looking for the eyes, how to make them seen again. Right. They don't want to give up the book completely. So he's on the right track by one to do that. And so because I would bring up McLuhan in 93-94, eventually, he asked me to explain the tetrad. So we always had a dinner after the class around 1 or 2 o'clock. We go to this symposium thing up there on 122nd Street on the west side. And so some of the followers of him there came to me and said, "Will you go on about McLuhan? What is it about McLuhan? I went to university. I studied philosophy. We studied Heidegger." I said, oh, yeah, Heidegger's okay, but McLuhan goes further. So I would tell them about Heidegger, and they didn't believe me. They said, that's fucking nuts. But then McLuhan started to be in the media a lot in the 90s, so they had to deal with that. They had no knowledge of McLuhan. So Bill would always get me to talk about McLuhan. He felt inadequate to it, so I would say it. So when he read this thing in 96, he talks about appreciation of McLuhan. So about four of my closer friends, allies in the group looked at me and nodded. Well, that's Bob. He's acknowledging Bob's bringing McLuhan back into the group of the world of New Age and that Thompson is a figure in, major figure. So that's what he's referring to. He came back to the Cathedral because we read books and we knew about McLuhan. The McKenna people didn't. And, you know, for me personally –
well, McKenna talks about McLuhan, but you're right. Like nobody
else.
Well,
here's what happened.
None of his followers are into it.
Right. So he read the letters in the late 80s, and he wrote a review. He was astounded. Holy shit, McLuhan's writing about LSD and how it's a product of the television era and all that stuff. He hadn't heard that perspective of his drug world. So then Neil Goldstein, I think his name is, was a friend of McKenna's, and I met him in 98, 99. So he told McKenna, you got to talk to Bob. So we started to email in the end of, what would that be? End of 98. And I raised some points that McLuhan say criticizing what he was saying, what he was missing. And he says, wow, this is very interesting. But I just got back to Hawaii. He lived on the Big Island.
Big Island, and yeah. I almost went to see him. I met him in San Diego, and he invited us there, but we couldn't get a ticket over.
What year was that?
97, 96? No, earlier, 94, 95, I think. 94, probably it was, yeah.
When you say we, who's we?
Me and my girlfriend at that time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, Big Island, he's over there. And he says, I've been on tour, I got a process deal, I got all this stuff. I'm very busy, but we need to talk. So that was late 98. Well, a couple months later, he got sick. And he was out of it for a year, and then he died like April 3rd, 2000. He died a year later.
Yeah.
So he never got to talk to me. So he didn't find out whatever I could have told him that he probably would have found interesting, because I would have talked his stuff and related to McLuhan more than he knew how to do, because he didn't know that much McLuhan. So he missed the connection to Bob and died.
That's too bad. You both were on the island. They both were in Hawaii at the same time.
Yeah, so we showed up here and in 2008. And I always remember him writing about the green flash. So when there's a sunset,
So you weren't in Hawaii until 2008.
Right. No, I wasn't. Oh, okay. I was in New York in 98.
All right.
I spent 15 years in Nova Scotia, and then from 77 to 93, 15 years in Toronto, then 15 years in New York. And now I'm just begun this week my 15th year in Hawaii. So 4 15s, and that means we got to get out of here if we follow the pattern. But where we're going to go is the secret hideout that Ian has made for us. When all the shit hits the fan, we've got a bunker to go to, an incredible bunker, and we're going to be riding it out there.
In New Zealand, everybody else. You're talking about?
No, that's just where I'm going to meet the aliens. That has nothing to do. Yeah. I don't know why it's in New Zealand. I've been there once with Andrew Crystal. It's a very green place, a nice place, but I don't know what the alien contact will lead to. But meanwhile, Ian is preparing a place for us to be bunkered when the nuclear war and all the shit that's going to happen over the next couple of years goes down. So why am I saying that? Why did I get into the bunker? So I figure I'll be gone within a year to the bunker, and I'll have done 15 years, like the previous three quadrants, you know, 60 years of phases. Nova Scotia was stationed there in the Secret Council of 10. That was my intelligence work from Europe. And then I went to Toronto to hang out with McLuhan. Then I went to New York to see the fall of the Android meme. The 15 years of New York was the end of New York and the end of the Android meme and the end of, you know, 9/11 happening. And New York never recovered from that. And then our life led us to Hawaii, which turned out to be the paradise. So what Ian says, this is the latest pattern. We went from revelation, all the stuff we studied for 40 years, from, say, 69 to 2009. Then Ian showed up to complete it. And we were put into Genesis, the Garden of Eden, at the end of the cycle. So we went from revelation, 40 years of journeying around and learning, your tinker gypsies, and then we end up stationed by accident in Maui on the way to Costa Rica, but that didn't turn out because of the financial collapse in September 2008, so we were stranded here. It turned out we were in the fifth gate, and then Ian was describing recently how the Garden of Eden bubble was the first stage of the fall of man. We fell at Andromeda, and Adam and Eve were put in a bubble, and then the bubble was there for a while, and they were doing okay, but then they ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil and fucked up, so they got kicked out of the bubble and went into the polluted world. The world that we're moving into, this new changed world with less oxygen, it was like that when the bubble of Garden of Eden came down, and so what we were from Andromeda couldn't survive out there, so we stayed inside the Garden of Eden. And that was pretty nice. And Ian says, we talk to, quote, God every day in the Garden of Eden. He would say, just like our shows, we talk and all kinds of discussion. And the serpent was lurking around. Sometimes Ayn says, I was the serpent, but it's nebulous. So anyways, I'm not sure if we were the Adam and Eve, but Ayn said anybody could have been the Adam and Eve. You just were a representative of the fallen condition from Andromeda. So we're enjoying the Garden of Eden, but then something made us screw up. Probably because Ophanel told the Andromedans to fall. So the first step was to get in the Garden of Eden bubble. But then, see, this is the logic of it. We got to fall some more and get kicked out of the Garden of Eden and really get in trouble. So Ophanel caused that as the serpent. So Adam and Eve were kicked out. And now here was this dangerous environment, but they could survive in it. But it was a real struggle. And the oxygen came back to help them a bit. But the goal is to get back to where it was with less oxygen so the aliens can come and get us out of this fallen bubble. Well, for me and Carolyn, this fifth gate we're in, and go to Andromeda. So that's a fantastic fucking novel I just laid out for you. It's a great movie.
Yeah. Like I said before, you got to watch Under the Silver Lake. This film, it came out in 2018, but it's all the one I told you about the bunkers.
Right. So what?
It's kind of a shitty movie, but it's interesting to think about this one, especially from your point of view.
Right. So what movies do you recommend? Under the Silver Lake. You got any others?
I've been watching movies from the 1920s and 1930s pretty well, constantly these days. So I don't know many recent movies at all. Yeah.
Okay. So Under the Silver Lake, and that came out a couple of years ago.
2018. But yeah, that's the one. Like I said, it's not a great movie or anything, but just the
theme of the bunker.
I think you'll love it for that, you know. Like, just you might even find something in it. There might even be some messages in there, which I saw as well.
By 2010, I realized how creative we could be with Ion, and he suggested some movie scenarios. And I said, "Well, maybe we'll get to the point where we can make some movies." He says, "Oh, you will." Now here it is, 12 years later, we never made any movies, but starting with Fringe. And every fucking year, especially J.J. Abrams made them, all these movies, Ayn would talk about them every year, and they always were based on people listening to our show. Scriptwriters or people with ideas in Hollywood would listen, get these crazy scenarios, and present them. And they'd make a movie which would fit the latest Ionic themes. And there's been a lot of them, and Ayn would point out every movie that came along that was doing visualizing what Ayn was talking about. So then I realized after 10 years, oh, this is how we're making movies. We talk it, let someone else make it. And
it's
process of making a fucking movie.
It's pretty obvious that these script writers are just like, they're starved for good ideas, right? So they're just scouring blogs and forums, and whatever. And then, you can see these ideas coming through. Like I sort of wonder myself about like things that I've written that have come out, you know, but I think they've done, and I've talked to other people who say the same thing, you know, it's like, wait a minute, that seems very
well.
Familiar.
They'd see if a lot of people are coming up with the idea, they say, okay, there's a meme. We can make a movie on that. It's got a market.
There's something that everybody's tapped into or something, yeah.
But what Ayn does, they do it before everybody. They lay out the ideas and then they point out the movie before anybody sees the movie. They say, this is what you're going to watch next. And this is the way we create our new civilization, which is what I always said we were going to do at Ayndom, through talking, the easiest method. And let other people do the grind work of making the shit, which comes and goes. And then it's obsolete, and you make another one. So I realized 10 years later, that's how we're doing it. Which Ayn didn't tell me 10 years ago that, well, you're not going to make any movies, Bob. You're just going to inspire them. So so people have told me, and people start to listen to the show and realize, says, you know, after listening to you guys, and then I work at this office and I talk to people, people, let's say 2013, they'd say people are talking ideas, stuff that Ayn says that I know they never knew 5 years ago. They never would think this way. And they documented through anecdotally the population changing. And now it's just regular to talk about parallel worlds, alternative timelines. It's in the culture all over the place. You know what I mean? Way more than 10, 15 years ago. Nobody talked that way. So that's what we did. And that's where Ayn is, the extension on physical, and it's the hidden ground of what's happening. Now, you're studying the correct stuff, so you tuned into it. You're picking up on the ion consciously, so to speak. By writing what you're writing.
Yeah. My take is that it's everywhere, right? So like even Andromeda. You talk about Andromeda, right? And so I immediately think about the myth of Andromeda, right? And she was a princess like tied to a rock. And she was going to be the sacrifice to this sea monster, basically the sea dragon. And then Perseus comes flying in with his winged sandals and ends up slaying the monster. And then, so I was just listening to Fry again the other day in his lectures, and he says that also is one of the myths of one of the creation myths of the hero slaying the dragon, the original sea dragon, right? And so you find that in the Babylonian, like this is one of the earliest written myths anyways, like in the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation myth. And it's Marduk, who's sort of the god of Babylon. And he slays his mother, who's a sea dragon called Tiamat. And she's divided, her body is divided into two, and it becomes the heaven and the earth, right? And so Fry is connecting that to the Bible, like you're saying, like you just said that before, there is no more sea, right? And so the reason there's no more sea is that the sea dragon has been killed. And in the Bible, it says, and then it's used as meat or as food for the people after that. And so in the Bible, like Moses and the Israelites were fed by manna, which was falling from the earth, right? And so that
was the ice cell. Manna was the ice cell.
That's the body of the sea monster, right? And so when you talk about Andromeda and then you're linking it up with Revelation and there being no more sea, then that's the closure of the myth, right? Again, that's another way to say it.
Right. So the Andromeda was a woman attached to a rock.
She was a princess. Yeah.
And the dragon came along and bugged her for a while, and Perseus saved her.
Yeah, it was Cassiopeia who was Andromeda's mother, and she boasted that Cassiopeia, was more beautiful than Poseidon's daughters, the Nereids. Mm-hmm. And then that goes back to Poseidon, and Poseidon unleashes this sea dragon on them, right? Mm-hmm. And then to prevent the sea dragon from just destroying their whole kingdom, Andromeda, their daughter, the princess, is offered to the tied, like chained to a rock, and then offered as a sacrifice to the sea dragon. And then Perseus comes and saves her.
Intervenes. And Perseus was a big guy in McLuhan's world. Remember, he held up the mirror to reflect the Gorgon.
To Medusa. Yeah, that's right. So that's the other part of the Perseus myth, the part before that, right? Once you get into myth, right? Once you get into the myth and then combining the myth with all of this other, with all the mythology that you're creating, then it gets even deeper and richer and crazier, you know?
You take these abstract themes that the myths represent, but the myths are alive and you can talk. I think Ayn is the sea dragon.
That makes sense because the sea dragon is the original mother, right? Who is who's basically chaos, who's basically all of spirit. Like that's ALP, like that's the cosmic form of ALP, you know? So that's Joyce's thing, right? Like he's always he considers the fall, like the fall of man, to be not the fall of man, it's the fall of God. And the fall happens because of the creation. And the reason why it's a fall is because, like in this myth I'm talking to you about, it's like he kills the original goddess of chaos and forms the world with her body, and then comes out and says he's the creator, which he's not. You know, he's using the body, like it's her that's the creator, and he didn't even really kill her. You know, she's still there. She's still there. She's just divided now divided from our perspective into heaven and earth, right? But from the perspective of eternity, she's still there, you know.
So the sea dragon.
That's why ALP is laughing at HCE all the way through, you know, like a.
Yeah. She's laughing at literate HCE.
Yeah.
It's a little more equal in the tribal societies.
That's right. That's right. So then you have the sacred marriage, right?
Right. Okay, so let me say this. So I'll say Andromeda is the ascension process and how it happened, and there's a latency, a potency. Right. So Carolyn is she's more public than me. She has a responsible position. She's a doctor, right? So she has to deal with all the levels. I'm just a jerk ball. I'm HCE fucking around, you know, making up shit. And so she gets trapped by the patriarchy or whatever you want to say, and she's tied to the rock. So then the sea dragon comes, I don't know, to help her. I'm saying the sea is the guff, and it's a dragon, and it's the pterodactyl. It could be bad, but it's a sea dragon. It's Ion coming, and Ion will be done away with at some point. And that's Perseus. Perseus intervenes. That's Ophanel. That's me, and I'm picking up on the rearview mirror metaphor of the mirror. Right. That's always been an image. Matter of fact, one of my mystical images, mystical visions I had in 1970 is I was transported someplace and I saw the sun, but it could have been the moon, reflecting off a mirror. And it was a really stark reflection. And so I thought, oh, there's the mirror. And this mirror. And then I would try to figure out what McLuhan meant by mirror, because art is rearview mirror. But often people say, oh, you're numb if you're in the rearview mirror. But you got to take the past and make it new. It's still a rearview mirror, but it's rejuvenated. And that's art. That's different from the numb rearview mirror. So those complications I've always thought about. So the mirror is a key thing that I'll claim as Ophanel. And so I'm the intermediary between the sea dragon and Carol.
Yeah, you could be Perseus, right? But it's like
that's what I'm saying.
The other thing. Like Andromeda and the sea dragon are basically the same. You know, that's what Robert Graves would say. You know, it's like that they're different phases of the same goddess. You know, and then the same in Finnegan's Wake. It's like ALP and the daughter Isabel are the same. You know,
Izzy. Okay, look at it this way. The woman is very important. So it's a tough problem for a stupid man. And so man needs a solution. So they create the guff and non-physical, which is Ion, which is actually a service and a disservice if you get too stuck in it. So the book got people stuck in a bad relationship with the guff and the sea, which was there to help you. So then the electric age, which is right hemisphere and feminine, comes back, and then that awakens the sea dragon to come forth and no longer be the sea dragon, but in the transition help the woman and the man. So when I made the tiny note chart, I saw that women were taking over, or the feminine, as Baudrillard would talk about, something, the mystery landscape.
Seduction.
Seduction, exactly. Yeah. I said, okay, I'm the last guy living with Carolyn, and she was curing AIDS and doing all this incredible stuff. So I said, I'm the guy that has to appreciate this and not resist it. So I said to Carol, here are some men who make the short list. I think you women should notice McLuhan, Zappa, Thompson, Croker, and LaRouche. You shouldn't throw men all away. You need to know what they have that you need to understand how you got into this situation where you didn't understand visual space. And I said, I represent those guys. So I made this chart saying, here's what Bob preserved as a Noah's Ark for the new level, which was the sixth level, which wasn't on the chart. But I said, waiting for organic bodies, the hexad, the waiting for organic bodies, the spinning clothing crystals have danced the hexadvertisement. And the hexad came after the tetrad and the pentad. So the sixth level was what Carol was doing with this new science. That's why I kind of clued into a new weird kind of science that you could make with this mirror technology that regular science wouldn't recognize and wouldn't be able to develop. So that's the hexadic level I thought she represented. So my chart predicted the hexadic, which turned out to be Ion, who pointed out to us that the hexadic is Ion in the world causing this turmoil. So it's the last, gasp of the dragon or the pterodactyl floating over the earth. Mm. So that's how we got to where we are today. The Andromeda myth, as you lay it out, and what Ion is the dragon and Bob is the Perseus. Now, this is all within language. This is not me, the person, or whatever you call my private citadel of consciousness. Remember, McLuhan said, media does not affect the citadel of consciousness.
Sure. Yeah.
That's your eternal essence or something.
Right.
You're not involved in social mortar. But within social mortar and talking about what's happening, and I was predicting this in 80s, that was my art, my social mortar coming, oozing out of me, which was me part of language. My reflex response to how language had gotten. And if you study the best, like Zapp and McLuhan, you'll be on the leading edge, and then you'll be ready to help create the new last gasp of social mortar, which is Ion. Mm. It's the last communication, which includes food. Remember, food's a medium. And so we provide the new food. So it's very symmetrical and poetic if you accept my premises or this Ion thing. You know what I mean? Not many people accept it or believe it.
I mean, yeah.
JW, he's a billionaire. And all of a sudden, Ion's coming through him. And within a week, he's sitting there. And he doesn't want to drink his coffee anymore. He doesn't want to smoke cigars, or I think it's mainly cigars. And he doesn't want to have his wine in the basement. You know, all the luxuries of being a rich guy. He just doesn't have a desire for it. And so I asked Ion, did you alter the etheric body of JW? They said, no, we altered chromosome 14. I go, chromosome 14, what's that? He says, that's part of your genetic makeup. It's the most important chromosome. And then a whole knowledge about chromosome 14 unfolded over the next few months. But I didn't notice all that. I was just processing 6 and 7 hours every other day. And Ginny, who runs our warehouse, she was pretty smart. She went back and listened to that chromosome 14 recording, which we were selling. She says, you know, Ion talks about chromosome 14 in that tape. I go, wow, way back then? Because this is a year later and I'm just learning and sort of starting to register about chromosome 14 in our new product. And she said, yeah, go back and listen to it. So I went back and said, holy shit, Ion mentioned a clue. And it wasn't the etheric body, which is theosophy and what people thought they knew. It was actually something in the body, in the genetic code, called chromosome 14. And it's really important. And I won't go into all the details that Ion said about it, but that's an example of Ion planting something very early that I would realize later. So why am I telling you this? So JW was altered because of chromosome 14. And he never – oh, yeah. So here it is. JW went through all this crazy drama all these years. And he said to me, you know, Bob, what you have done to me and what has happened is ridiculous. And I don't fucking believe it, but it's working out, so I'm stuck with it. That's JW's position now. I don't believe what's happening. I don't believe that I'm involved with the Queen and everybody else. I can understand it, but you started this fucking thing, and what a mess. Well, maybe not a mess you've gotten us into, Buck. So where they're still trying to poison him. So that's part of the drama here. It's a freaking great story. And when all this is cleared up in 20 years, boy, wait till I get to tell you what really has been going on the last 15 years. It's even more amazing.
How many people show up for these the big sessions you have, the big radio sessions these days?
Ian says millions now. Over the past year, see, nobody believes anything. Everything fell apart, especially the last. You see, Hollywood fell apart with Weinstein and Me Too. Sport fell apart because of taking the kneeling. Then what was the final thing to fall apart? Medicine and science. Right. And they fucked up with COVID, right? The establishment.
Right.
And Ian predicted this would happen. And who would be left standing? Bob and Carol and Ian with the solutions. And Ian said, you're going to have to wait for everybody to come through, do their thing and fail, which is where we're at. So what was your question? I was going to answer. So what did you just say that made me say this? You can't remember. We're so involved in the moment. You can't remember what you said.
We got to back up the tape, but
yeah. Wait. So I was explaining JW. Maybe this will trigger you, and how JW doesn't believe it, or he's not sure. And we've gotten to this crazy business. Oh, in 20 years, I'm going to tell you the real story. That must have made you think something.
It was.
I'm going to fill in the details. And then you start to say, well, if you're going to fill in the details, what is it? What's your question or statement?
Hey, go on. Come on.
Let me retrieve a little more. So I said that I'll tell you in 20 years all the great stuff. And it's right then that you said something.
My mind has gone a whole like a million different places, so it's hard to retrieve.
Well, that sounds like a bit like it. What did what would I say at that point? You say, well, what are you gonna do about this? Or maybe say something like that. What do we do? Maybe most people say, what do we do, Bob? What do we do next? Right?
They look for instruction. I don't think it was that, but I don't know. I was asking who met for the radio sessions. Like how many people?
The audience. Yeah. The audience, then, right.
No, but so not even the audience. The audience.
I got the answer. I got it. So I was telling you everything fell apart, and then I gave examples of what fell apart, all the institutions, all the myths. Universities are falling apart. So Ian says there's a lot of people watching and knowing what the fuck do you listen to now? There's no authority out there anywhere. You can't trust anybody. So as I've been saying, it's a post-information society. So they're finding out about us. And Ian is the only thing that's got the guts to sound confident and talk about what's going on and be pretty right on the money. So
I think a lot of people went quiet too, like I did, you know. It's something.
Well, you didn't know what to say next.
Yeah, that and fatigue or
and at the end
or,
it come.
Like just, yeah. Or just
the ever getting to come. What more is there to say? Everybody can see the horror, and now like they're waiting for it.
After I put out the book, it was like, it kind of like, I had to go back into myself and come up with something else, you know, that kind of feeling, you know.
Right. I know. You've blown your wad, come your load, and you have to have a fallow period to see what new environment you're going to make in yourself. So we're the only ones who have something to say, and everybody's coming around to us, and millions are listening. But I had always joked through the years that I had 11 listeners, and that's all I had was 11 listeners. And there are about 11 people who are the most regular. They've been here for years, and they never leave. They always show up, and they do their homework as much as they can, and Bert's the best at it. And but now there's no more 11. And so I was looking at our angel diagram, which we got from chapter 23, and there's this 11th ring, and it's got the seven empires. So I said to Bert the other day, you know, the 11 listeners, seven of them are the empires. Now, the empires are the oligarchy, the real oligarchy, is sitting there watching everything. Mm. And if you ascend and you start to build an empire here, you will have to confront them. They will confront you. They will test you. So I said, holy shit, Ian's talking about, when he says the 11 listeners, the only ones that count are the seven empires and four others who might be aliens or angels or something. So I now realize that the 11, my metaphors, the 11 listeners were the ones that mattered. And now they're forced to come to us because we've reached that point. And this alien thing, now I don't know when the alien thing's going to happen. Maybe it'll never happen. Maybe it'll happen in a different form. But I take Ion seriously that I have to go out there every night and see if they'll show up. And I go out there and there's the cat looking at me. You know, they always sit there on the wall. That's what I'd say. Join all the people that are coming in to listen now. You see, Ion satirized the social mortar. He's communicating and wrapping up everything, but it's all irrelevant because it's all mind stuff. And you got to figure out how the mind, which Ion says is the most powerful part of yourself, that frustrates your ascension. And that's natural because when you ascend, you then can use your mind playfully. You're not hypnotized by it, like we were saying. You're not stuck in the sensory extensions that the mind creates. So when you take, when we first, our first products were the RNA drops, they were called. When you took them, your mind stopped dominating your thinking. It would soften it, it buffer it. And that was the first beginning of slack we offered. Your mind got, quote, controlled. It got suppressed positively, and you felt you could remain feeling good without getting distracted by mind issues, which always interferes with people. That was the effect of the first product. It softened the mind.
Yeats has a great kind of metaphor about that. Like, he talks about the mind becoming like a cool, like a calm pool where all the ripples sort of like disappear from it, and then it becomes reflective like a mirror. And then once that happens, that's when all the spirits of the forest and all the animals and stuff go to look at themselves as a mirror in the reflection of the water. So your mind becomes like that. Like, that's,
you said they look at themselves as a mirror. They're a mirror?
No, your mind becomes a mirror because it's calmed down now. And so now it's like a reflective pool, you know. Before it was just wavy and nothing reflects it.
Yeah. You're saying you see all this phenomena in your mirror.
Yeah, they can see their own images in the mirror. Like, they are attracted by your mind because it's become calm now, you know.
So do you see them see themselves?
I think so, because you're just, at that point, you're just like, you're just observing, right? Like, your mind has calmed down, right? So so that makes sense.
It allows the non-mind to happen,
right?
The other parts.
Yeah, exactly. All the even we would call them external, but they might not be, like, all these discarnate images or what, like, entities or whatever they are, you know.
The irrational that your mind can't explain and thinks it has to within the prison of life and death, you think you have to explain whether these
you're
are
thinking all the time and just blah, 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 and there's ripples all over the place and nothing's reflecting. You know, like, that's what my mind does most of the time.
Remember, what did you say earlier? Moving on? Oh, yeah, the guy said that you keep moving on. Your mind. And the frame of that is the fear of nothingness, the fear of death. So once you get over the fear, which I felt a lot with Aya more and more, I feel in being in eternity. I can't conceive of dying anymore. That's been the effect of rubbing up against Aya in all these years. Is so, I don't know, validation of so much stuff that I don't see how I could die as long as I've got the products. So that's pretty crazy. You talk to people, and I'm pretty old, and they say, Bob, you know, you're doing great, but I'm going to be dead soon. Well, fucking stop it. Get on our products. You won't die. Come on. I'm going to fucking die, Bob. No, you're not. That's the last crazy thing one can say to someone. Hey, no, stay alive. You don't get to die. I can see you start saying that to your friends. I ain't dying. Snore is not dying.
Well, You've got the ocean there for you too. Me too. Like I can go swimming the ocean all the time, which is like a huge thing.
I got the perfect environment. You know, I got utopia. I the perfect exercise is swimming, and the water can be big or small. It changes all the time. Sometimes there's big, huge waves. That's a lot of fun if you know how to swim through them.
Yeah, I do that here.
What'd you say?
I do that here. Yeah, same thing. The only difference is it gets
Japan. What part of Japan are you in?
I'm right on the ocean, like right down from, sort of right down the coast from Kamakura. Do you know Kamakura, the old capital?
No. Are you near Tokyo?
It takes me about like an hour and a half by train to get to Tokyo.
Okay, so you
maybe an hour to get to hour probably to get to Tokyo.
And you have a nice beach there?
Yeah, it's pretty nice. Yeah, like it's not the Hawaii standard beach, but it's nice for Japan. You know, like it.
And you go in the water.
Oh yeah. The it's nice enough. Like it's the emperor's summer residence, right? So they keep that beach really nice.
Right. Is there still an emperor?
Oh yeah. There's just been a new one recently.
Oh, okay. He keeps a low profile. At least in my mind, I don't see anything about him ever.
Yeah. Especially the new one, I haven't heard much at all about him. Like the old one is still there. He's retired. I think he actually spends a lot of time in this town, secretly. But but these guys, the Japanese emperors are in the order of the garter, with Queen Elizabeth being the top.
Yeah.
You know, of all these different monarchies, like that's a really exclusive. Secret society only for monarchs, you know, like.
That's right. No, I talked about the Order of the Garter, and I think he said Ofenau's been a member of the Order of the Garter for a long time. But JW, before Ion happened, he wanted Balmoral, which I thought was a crazy fantasy. Well, now it's even closer to it, and he's really helping the Queen, and there's some consideration going on, depending on the Queen's last statement is, "The monarchy will die if Bob doesn't pull this off." That's what she said. It's not going to make it. And so she's counting on it. And if it does die, then she'll give Balmoral to JW. So when I heard about this, I said, "JW, I want a knighthood. You know, Bob, I'm in the middle of this. I'm helping. So I want a knighthood." And so she says, "Bob wants a knighthood? Why?" And JW quotes me, "Oh, he wants to get some respect." She started laughing. He said she laughed for 5 minutes. And then later, her very last words lately were, "Tell Bob," she said through some of these wealthy elites, her people said that were meeting with JW, said, "Tell Bob that I hope to be as narcissistic as he is someday." Which I thought was pretty fucking neat, because she's kind of a narcissist. You have to be in her position.
Know,
everybody has to bow to her, all kinds of rules, right? Isn't that kind of a narcissism? For pre-literate people, it is.
You couldn't get away with that
in a fucking tribal society.
The only way she could escape that is if she really identified with the nation, with the kingdom, you know, like that she's not an individual. She's the whole kingdom.
I that's the way she lives. She doesn't, there's a great impersonality, JW says, interacting with her.
But
she's not there.
You said she died, or like she was killed, or it was she?
No. She got very in trouble. And she got a very bad health situation, and our products kept her going.
All right, yeah.
And revitalized her, because she was on our products, but she wasn't doing them right. So Carol had to write it out. "Look, this is what you do," because she hardly could make it through the Jubilee. But she got some stuff just before the Jubilee that strengthened her enough so that she could stand up for a while. She can't stand up for a long time right now. So she couldn't go to everything, but she went to a few things and stood there and looked like she was okay. She looked okay in the face because our products made her face look good, but her hips were hurting.
Mm-hmm.
So JW is, you know, he helped make that happen. You know, we saved Trump in October 2020. You remember when he got COVID one weekend?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like
he was taking monoclonal antibodies, right?
Well, that's his cover story. He's taking ours. So he's been on our stuff since 2015. His whole family is. So on October 10th or something, that weekend, whatever the date was, this is 2 weeks before the 3 weeks before the election. Carolyn gets an email from Melania saying, I know you've heard that Trump's got in the hospital, but he's not doing well. And I've run out of products. Can you get some to him? So Carolyn contacted JW, who was flown up to Walter Reed's hospital. Yeah. Yeah, Walter Reed Hospital. Went in there on a Friday night, and he gave the doctors our stuff. And then he sat there all night, and the doctors would come out, you know, every hour or so saying, yeah, he's still alive. He was going down pretty bad. And then as the evening went on, he got better and better, and the doctors didn't know why. They just knew to do our stuff, and they knew Trump wanted it. So by the morning, he had come out of it. And then he recuperated over the next 2 days. And like on Monday, he went out in front of the White House, and people said he was looking unstable, but he was standing there and saying he was cured. And yeah, apparently
he was he had this plan to have a Superman T-shirt underneath his shirt, and he was going to rip out his shirt and just show the Superman.
Well, he might have been humbled by what happened, and he wasn't going to make fun of it. So on Saturday, Sunday, he'd improved and wasn't going to die. And the doctors had a press conference, and they said they named Remdesivir, that funny word, and something else, and maybe they said some vitamins, or they just said Remdesivir. Then Sunday they had another press conference, and they then added vitamin C and zinc or something. Now that's our stuff. And then Monday came out, Trump just said, I had miracle products, and it was a blessing from God. He put it on the God level. And he was talking about our stuff, but he's told not to talk about our stuff, because if the world heard about this, a billion people would want it right away and demand it. Our factory isn't big enough to do that, so we can't do it. So we don't want it out there. You find out in your own lucky streak whether if you find out about us, then you get better. So, you know, that's the way it is. Eventually people will know, and then maybe we'll be able to handle it, but we can't handle. You know, you understand, right? If Trump got better and he named it, everybody would want it immediately, right?
Yeah. He's pretty vague about what got him better.
Yeah. And he's kept vague about it because we told him to. It would disrupt our whole thing because there's a lot of people that are alive and dependent on our products, and we can't have that upset. So the FDA, they better watch it if they try to stop the products. That's fucked. Then they're getting in trouble. Some things. The Sea Dragon ain't gonna put up with that, you know.
Hey, Bob, I gotta get out of here soon.
Well, we've come to a good conclusion.
My family making noise. If you wanna say any final comments about the article, I'd love to hear it.
I wanted to go through that. Let's see. Go to page 306 or so. Yeah. You have Mirza McMullen, Moonchild, me. So Mirza McMullen is the term Joyce uses on page 254 of Finnegan's Wake to describe McLuhan. And the description of the words around him, that name, are so accurate.
Right.
Have you looked at them?
Yeah. I think
When I did the archives, a lot of the boxes, there were 60 boxes of newspaper clippings in file folders. So that's Cleo's clippings. And then it says, I don't have the quote right here, it says, these things are what would occur to anyone. There's something obvious about McLuhan's media talk. To say the book's an extension of the eye, that's kind of silly and obvious. And people say, oh, yeah, it's an extension of the eye. What's profound about that, right? So if you've got Finnegan's Wake right there, you could bring it out and say the quotes, see the words I'm talking about.
That's so
page 254.
254, yeah.
Now you see, Mercer McMullen, read what it says after that. As might occur to anyone.
Yeah, I like it. I like what it says right before that too. It says Orion of the Orgiasts.
That's the 60s. The Orgiasts. Yeah. Yeah, that's the 60s where a lot of the chemical body humanist orgies happened, right?
Right. And then the
Ipse
Dadan, product of the
extremes. That's his dadaistic self. That's the data part of himself.
Product of the extremes, giving quotidians to our means.
Means are the media. Means are media.
Right.
And he made them extreme. He hyper-exaggerated their effect.
Right, right.
And quotidians means cliches. He wrote cliched archetype. So those words exactly fit him.
As might occur to anyone, your Brutus Layman with the princess champion in her archdeaconcy. Or so.
Now, wait a minute. The layman is that he and Don Thiel were the only laymen at St. Michael's. Everybody was a Brazilian priest there. So they were laymen, and then he got brought into the elite. He spoke at Buckingham Palace, the princess champion of the archdeaconry. The elite used him to create the idea of a global village to prepare for the world globalist vision. You know what I mean? He was exploited. So the archdeaconry did that to him.
Wow. And then so he clept from Clio's clippings.
Yeah, now Clio is the word you give in advertising. Now, it wasn't around back then, but Clio can refer to Cleopatra, but it's Clio's clippings in Explorations, if you've ever seen it. He has a picture of the New York Times with a female goddess superimposed it. So the female seduction and goddess of media and electric telegraph media is like Clio's clippings, Cleopatra's clippings.
She's also the muse of history. Right. So Clio's clippings is history, right?
Newspaper is the daily history.
Right. Yeah, that's and then the next part is banging. Well, no, not yet. Which the chronicler of chivalries is suspicious, save he scan.
Scans. Right. So the chronicle of chivalries is what he was an expert on was the medieval period. That's what his PhD was about.
Right. And then this one. This one should be obvious to everybody. For ancients link with presence as the human chain extends.
But let's go back to chivalry's Clio clippings. What's the words right after that?
That's what I'm saying.
There's some other words there.
Oh, chronicle of chivalries is suspicious, save he scan.
Ah, the scanning is his famous statement about the scanning finger of the TV set.
Right.
Okay, and he scanned, he said, to write understanding media, he would look anywhere to find anything, including newspaper clippings, which were in the 60 boxes. He would just grab newspapers and then make a book out of these clippings. But he would scan, and that's also what television did, and he did a mosaic scanning method of writing. That's literally how he did his books. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, it is amazing.
And then that's his PhD.
Yeah. This is a great one. For ancients link with presence as the human chain extends.
Right. So he discussed the ancient. He said, what is it?
Ancients link with presence.
No. And then what'd you say?
As the human
chain extends.
As the human chain extends.
Okay. So you've got. He writes in his PhD about the ancient quarrel between the ancients and the moderns, but it was called moderni. That's what his knowledge, his breakthrough knowledge is in the early 40s. And then he says that we're retrieving ancient sensibility, the patriarchal fathers, way back there, tribal stuff. It's all retrieved. And so the ancients become the presence. It's McKenna's archaic revival. The ancients become the presence due to the extensions of ourselves.
Right, the human chain extends. Yeah. And that goes right back to Ulysses, right, where he's talking about the cord from the umbilical cord coming out and being able to contact, like right back to Eve, like he says.
And then that's even Ion, going back to original source. So the extensions are presented evolutionary as an evolution of technology. That supersedes the evolution of nature of Darwin. You have the evolution of technology, which Joyce and them intuited. So that's totally fits. And then what's said after extends?
Have done, do, and will do again as John Polycarp and I renews eye to eye, I witnessed, and to Patty Palmer.
That's there's the eye and, yeah. And observing.
Eye to eye, for the, eye witness. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what he was doing. I observe the effects so I can retrieve the eye with an eye book that replays the Finnegan's Wake eye book. So that's obvious, that stuff there, right? That's him. That's describing him.
And then this one, I don't know, Patty Palmer. Like, I guess this would be St. Patrick's. Monks sell you to archers on the water of the living goes the way
hold
of
it there.
All fish.
The monks sell you to the archers? The monks are of digital technology. That's but everybody in their little cloister blogging. And then you have surveillance capitalism, which hijacks the monks that are blogging stupid information as if it's significant.
Sell you. So the you is the tree you, you know, Y-E-W, right? So that's that's the sacred tree as well, right? Like that.
Right, and the archers are picking you off. That's the what McClune called the trigger men, the hit squads. The monks get archered.
He might. I'm just thinking of this. This might be talking about the Zodiac as well. Like it's
Zodiac
talking about
killer.
No. I mean the signs, like the archer, and then it goes to the water, the way of all fish goes to Pisces.
The Polycarp sounds like a fish. Now, that's a fish with multiple parts. That's the fish that doesn't know it's in water. McClune always uses that.
It's the way of all flesh also with the novel by Samuel Butler. Samuel Butler's weird source too. Like he's the one who talks about
Erewhon?
Erewhon is one of his ones, and then the way of all flesh, and then he's got a bunch of nonfiction stuff where he talks about the memory of a cell or the memory of the egg that is primordial. It basically goes back to the beginning of life, right? Like the actual cell never dies. And so the memory never dies. And so all of us have this memory in us.
And he's writing that in the 19th century. Samuel Butler. So then what's next? I know it starts to dissipate the last few lines of the paragraph. I don't know what to fit in there.
Way of all fish from Sarah's drawhead, the quarrelsome to Isaac's, the loft but one. Okay, so he's talking about Sarah and Abraham and then Isaac, the loft but one, the last but one. So he's talking about Jacob and Esau, the butt one.
And Sarah's can be sores, the sores we get from the media.
Yeah.
The plagues, the diseases.
And then with her mini lisp exterior, he says.
That's the extension of the right hemisphere. That's women.
This is what I've got. Highlighted too, this one, monolith. This is the monolith, right?
You know about the monoliths? The recent ones?
Oh, yeah. Those are weird too, eh?
Yeah. Oh, I'd explain. When I go to the bunker, the EMP will happen, no communications, but I'll be able to broadcast through those monoliths, which were put there probably by aliens, the new aliens, to be my network of broadcasting when there's no electronics available anymore. That's what the monoliths mean, according to Ion.
Well, that's
how's that one?
That's good.
Yeah, that's good. Good. What's next?
So then it gets to, so Perichon with Bastion, or Heavy Humph with Airy Nan, and this massive word, Ricker, Acker, Brim, Billy, Jackie, Juck, Jolly Cass.
That's Ion. McClure would transform into Ion, or Finnegan's Ease into Ion. That's all babble from Ion.
Well, that's So I think that's Rousseau, but that's also what is I'm spacing on it. The magazine that Jolas, who is talking about the
transition,
the revolution of the word.
Transition.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, transition. How so is thou, Dulcisamica, and that's.
I had talked to the dulcimer recently. How important the dulcimer is.
That's also from. I'm spacing out. That's Don Quixote. Like Dulcima, like the muse of Don Quixote.
Hmm.
And then finally it's Abiad. And that's according to some that's from Egyptian religion, this in one interpretation that I've read.
Then it could be the alphabet. The alphabet
for sure. And then a Babel man dub gulch of tears.
So that's the Babel.
Tower of Babel, right?
Yeah, that McClellan was dealing with.
Yeah.
He saw the Babel early. Yeah, that fits. Well, very good. I had never gone through the last lines like that. So we learned something there. So I want to go through, it's very important when you come to that point, you say, in short, the extensions of humanity had evolved to the point of actualizing their own form of cognition.
Yeah.
That was great how you led up to that. And then you say, at this point, I will not get into Dobbs' incredibly intriguing thoughts on this third phase, and presumably the fourth phase we're all living through right now. That's what we've been discussing, the fourth phase, Android Meme Plus, which Dobbs, you call the third phase, the Android Meme, which is correct, and then the fourth phase is the tech body. But my attention here also revolves around McLuhan's key theoretical obsession with the drama of cognition and perception. Now, have you ever looked at Renaissance, the Catholic journal in the 50s? You ever looked at that?
No.
Okay. There's a lot of talk in there, similar to page 32. I have the interior landscape here. Page 32, if you look it up, there's stuff about they are the representatives of the age-old adequation of mind and things, enacting the drama of the endless adjustment of the interior acts and dispositions of the mind to the outer world. The drama of cognition itself, for it is in the drama of cognition, the stages of apprehension, that Joyce found the archetype of poetic imitations. He seems to have been the first to see that the dance of being, the nature imitated by the arts, has its primary analog in the activity of the exterior and interior senses. Joyce was aware that this doctrine, and then in brackets, that sensation is imitation because the exterior forms are already in a new matter, this doctrine is implicit in Aquinas. He made it explicit in Stephen Hero and the Portrait, and founded his entire poetic activity on these analogical proportions of the senses. So that, I don't know if you know that, that's page 32, 33, and 34 are really important. He says, if Daedalus on 34, if Daedalus was the first...
That's from where?
Interior Landscape, the essay James Joyce, Trivial and Quadrivial. You know, the collection of his criticism.
Yeah, that's almost sounds like what I was writing.
Yeah, see, yeah, you were... You haven't read the Joyce articles?
On what? On the...
In 53, he wrote two articles, Joyce, Mallarmé, and the Press, and then James Joyce, Trivial and Quadrivial.
Oh, by McLuhan.
Yeah. You don't have it to your landscape.
I'm quoting those afterwards. That's why... okay, that makes sense then. So you're quoting McLuhan.
I'm quoting McLuhan writing about Joyce, and you wrote similar stuff.
No, I've quoted those passages.
Okay, yes, you know about them.
Yeah.
Do you have the interior landscape?
No, I don't. Yeah, that's
you got it because he spells out this whole thing, McLuhan's key theoretical obsession with the drama of cognition perception. Renaissance and these articles provide the detail that you're working out. And then you have the Endor meme replays that. And then you have the tech body takes it further extreme, like page 254, and extremes the memes, makes mm-hmm. the memes extreme. He extremes the Android meme, and you would get, you'd get what you're talking about is okay for phase one, but you want to read and complete the Dram of Cognition in Joyce's literary criticism, and then go back and read my essay and where I'm going to, which you're interested in.
Yeah, did you get to the last essay that I wrote on the one that's called Mosaic? That's where I sort of spin off, you know. Like, so
you mean in the book here?
Yeah, in the book, the last.
You know, I read all three. I've only read 25, 26, and 27, those chapters. I haven't read any other part of your book.
Oh, okay, yeah. So the last one is where it spins off, you know.
Let me see where it says Mosaic. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you get television kills telephony. We'll have to go over this another time, I think, in detail. Because it's too much to do right now. You got to go. And we did the Finnegan's Wake line, which is really good, the Mirza McMullen. That's what your essays are coming from.
Right.
But then the particulars, I did want to go through it and point out stuff. Like you got Powell, you got Fry, you got all kinds of important stuff in here. But I think it is preliminary to my five bodies.
Mm.
The Endor meme is made up of the five bodies, and that's what we're trying to get you to get to next. Yeah, here it is, the last paragraph. The senses recombine, perception is cleansed, dullness retreats, the Freemasonry of the arts, for good or for ill, becomes obsolete, and the multitudinous child of the moon and sun is born as they awaken Albion, or not, abandon the tomb of dead white men. That you got to see how maybe it goes into the five bodies. This right. is a plateau statement. The afterglow.
Well, the five bodies are there though. Like they're not in your terms, but they're there with the five senses, including
right, but that's
including
that's,
tactility in the center, right?
Right, but the bodies obsolesce, remove the five senses. You have to see how technology in the digital phase is not the senses. It's actually extension of tactility, but what is extended from tactility is these machinic environments, which Croker and I call bodies. Mm. And that's the TV body and the chip body. That is more accurate to what's going on. People aren't juggling their senses anymore. That's chemical body limitation. They're juggling the environments, which are these bodies, the astral body, the after image of the chemical body, and the TV body and chip body, and an ion is the mystery body or the mystery landscape. So the landscapes of the first half of the 20th century, radio and TV are big environments. They get shrunk, miniaturized by the digital, and they become tiny, and they become organs or bodies. That's what we're juggling today. And that explains more about what people are experiencing in their quadriphenic confusion of not their senses, of their bodies. And so you've got this Clinton and people like that. They say they grew up on the chip body. They had no sense of their chemical body. He didn't even couldn't even get an erection. And all this stuff with his sex life was all killed by the chip body. Now, that's beyond sensory dynamics when you're killing your penis. You know what I mean? That's because your chemical body is miniaturized and sidelined by excessive chip body use. So that's the interplay that explains a lot of the dilemma that's going on with the millennials and younger. They're juggling and they're now into the hexadic body, which is the effect of ion. So you got the millennials and the younger sitting there, not listening to any authorities because none of them work anymore. And they're saying, what's here now? Well, we're here. I am them. And we can communicate and say, okay, you got a big problem as an unhealthy 20-year-old? Go on our products. Don't go on the regular medicine, which they're all on, and it's killing them. It's real stupid what they're on. And Big Pharma knows this. We recommend our stuff. And then if they found out about cold fusion, cold play, and the breakthroughs, they'd get a little less depressed. Yeah, but they got to go through this Armageddon. Now, here's what's the final statement I'll make. Ein says that the womb is closed, sperm doesn't work anymore, and all babies born today, when did you have your baby?
Last one was, what, 16, right at the beginning. Yeah.
Oh, okay, that might have made it. As of right. late, all babies are half angels.
Hmm.
They're not human, and most of them are going to die in the starvation and bad times that are coming. They're not meant to survive. So there's the drastic apocalyptic statement from us here in Iondom, broadcasting on Saturday night on the Znor channel.
What's your take on Bowie?
David Bowie?
Yeah.
I prefer Zappa. Bowie's okay, but he's too much a product of the Endor meme. He didn't know how to get out of it. And so he just tossed from one medium to another, and he ends up hanging out with the old art world. He does not get McLuhan and the media environments as art. He goes back to magazines and the New York scene. So that'll kill him. So he died. He didn't find Bob. He didn't get revitalized.
Hmm. Yeah, he's another one that sort of appeared in a dream, like a really significant dream that I had. And then
he communicates well to the Generation X. He's more important than Zappa for them, but they don't know Zappa. They don't know the intricacies of Zappa.
Well, this is what I'm talking to Wally about, right? Like
Wally Sherrod?
Yeah. Yeah, Wally's deep into Zappa. To Zappa.
Oh! We should have a dialogue. Yeah, you and I and him, because that's my expertise.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be great.
Yeah, why don't we do your essay here overlap with Bowie, Zappa, and Walter?
That'd be cool. See? Yeah. I could contact him, and I'm sure he'd love that. Like, he'd love to talk about that. You guys could just geek out on Zappa, and I'd just sit and listen.
Oh, you could add whatever comes to your mind, because it'll happen synchronistically. You'll think of things like you did tonight. Right. You could have just geeked out and let me talk about Ion, but all this Ion resonance came out of you, so that'll happen. and I already did an interview with him. I don't know where it is. It's probably on my archive, but he interviewed me once back then when we first started talking SyncBook. So, yeah, we could do part two. Now, has he read this last part of your book?
He's read it, I think. Yeah, he's got it anyways. I sent him a
Ask him to review it or look at it, and let's we will do this book and relate it to Zappa. There's a lot of McLuhan in Zappa.
Yeah,
nobody knows this.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so there it is. We've got our assignment for how we'll do the rest of your essays here. We'll do it with Walter.
He would love that, I think. So I think, we just gotta. The problem will be getting the time zones right, because he's in London, you're in Hawaii, I'm in Japan, so it's gonna.
Well, if he's I think it would be he's 12 hours ahead of me, so he'd be Sunday also.
Yeah, if he can,
he'd be later in Sunday, I think.
If he could sync it up with his family, like he has his problem getting time, but I've talked to him at this time too, right? So it's possible.
You have talked to him at this time.
Yeah, I forget. Like he normally wants to talk to me when it's my evening and it gets late for me. But we could probably reverse it. Like it would be late for him, I think.
Okay, let's after his family's gone to bed or something, take a couple hours. He can do.
Anyways,
that.
He'll work it out. Like he'll be excited to do it. So I'm sure he'll be able to work out a time sometime.
And we'll send this recording to him, and he can review it here.
Yeah, all the how many hours is it?
How long was it? I called you at 4, probably got started at 4:30, so it's 5 hours at least.
Yeah, I think it's already made it. I think Skype now makes automatic, like it cuts it into different recordings. So now we're at almost 6 hours. Yeah.
So it'll be four and a two maybe.
All right. I hope I get
4 hours and a 2 hour.
All right, Bob. So I got to get out of here then.
Yeah, but it'll be divided. 4 hours and then 2 hours.
Yeah.
The so recording.
I guess they'll just give it to me in the chat afterwards. Do you know how this works?
No. I've never recorded on Skype, so let it unfold. Ask somebody.
Here it is.
Yeah, so, you turned it off? It's right there.
I've got the first recording, right? If you look at the you can get it right now too, actually. You could download it right now. You know, if you go to the chat.
Let's see, where's the chat? Skype.
Yeah.
So I bring up Skype. Where's chat?
It's got the little speaking icon or something like that. What is it? Yeah,
I click on chat.
And there it is. There's the first.
Available for 30 days. So what do I hit to download it?
I'm not sure. Just try a right click or something. See if that works. Yeah, right here. Save to downloads or save to something. Save as something. So just we might as well both do that.
Yeah,
So I'm going to save it now.
I have Mac. So it's not saying I can't right click. So what? Click on that. No. I don't want to. Recording is available for 30 days. I'll have to ask somebody. I don't want to click the wrong thing.
You can just try clicking it. Just without the back click, and you might be able to get in.
It says open video. Don't want to do that. So it has a little arrow in the center and then a little blue thing with a human head and then your ladder on the left. What would I click to download?
Just click, not sure, but with a Mac, but just click, try clicking the whole thing and see what comes up. You're not going to lose it. Like I've saved it now anyway, so.
Yeah, you saved it. It's convenient. And so, don't worry about it. I'll ask somebody.
Yeah, I'll save both parts anyways. Now it's downloading this part now, so.
Yeah, it's convenient if I can download it because I can send it to my web guy and he can put it up right away.
Yeah, cool. So you'll have it for 30 days, like they said, so you'll be able to do it.
So you don't mind it being public?
No, I don't think we talked about anything too personal or anything.
Yeah. No, it's good. It actually explains a lot of what you've been doing and the sync up with me. That's surprising. So it's worth putting it on your resume.
I don't know. I don't know if anyone's going to go through the whole 6 hours to.
Well, the ones that are supposed to that will get some from it will. They won't be able to avoid it. Some 19-year-olds will get zapped. They'll be there, McLuhan. Yeah. They'll say, "Wow, all the stuff we said."
They're Finnegan's Wake. This recording.
Yeah, Finnegan's Awake. Okay, man. Great talking to you, Snor, and it was very surprisingly amazing. So we got a lot done.
Yeah, that was great, Bob. Nice to talk to you. Good to hear from you for years now, and just picked it up where we left off.
Right, like you said we would. So I'll wait to hear about Walter from you.
Cool. Okay, I'll let him know as soon as I can.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Yeah, see you, man. All the best.
Yep. Bye.